I knock.
What? You liar, you ain't got no pad hand. You didn't deal yourself no pad hand.
Make your draw a shit heap.
You guys want to go see a dead body?
Not really, under the circumstances. No, I really don't. I'm sorry. And it's nothing against Stand By Me. But there's something about the events of December 14th, 2025, specifically the murder of Rob Reiner and Michelle Singer Reiner, with one of their sons charged with their alleged murder, that makes this all feel wrong, isn't there? He was 78, she was 70, not young, but still too soon, and for goodness sake, not like this. Rob Reiner was the beloved actor from All in the Family, who managed to turn into one of the great directors. Is that too big a call? Maybe. But it feels right after such a horrible death, doesn't it? A shocking death tends to change the conversation. He certainly had one of the great film runs. You've heard about it. Starting with This Is Spinal Tap and ending with A Few Good Men, encompassing films like Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, and Misery, with appropriate respect shown to The Sure Thing. North would eventually end his hot streak in the 90s, but only because Frank Darabont insisted on directing The Shawshank Redemption. That could have been Rob Reiner, but I digress. Today we're going to zone in on Stand By Me, where Vern presents to his best friend some information that will change their young lives, that he knows where the body of young Ray Brower is. Chris, Gordy, and Teddy join Vern to go and see the body and to alert the authorities and become famous. It's the late 1950s. The boys are 12 or 13. The movie is framed by a now adult Gordy, a writer, finding out about the recent death of Chris, who was the leader of that group, played brilliantly by River Phoenix. Stand By Me is a movie that explores male relationships in a skillful way, accepting the boys as layered and vulnerable, especially Gordy, and especially Chris. I'm sure the film played well in 1986, but I was born after that. I was 5, in fact, when River Phoenix died. By the time I had seen this for the first time, which was sometime in high school when a teacher was having a quiet end-of-term day and wheeled out the TV with the attached VCR to put Stand By Me on for everybody, the legend of River Phoenix was already well known. The story takes on extra gravitas, and you can't help but especially focus on his performance, which carries the film with so much wisdom behind the eyes. Chris's character is deceptively smart and kind, despite his upbringing and his older brother, and he is Gordy's biggest supporter, while resigning himself to a fate of always being in Castle Rock. It's a superb performance, but did I notice it more because of his death just 7 years after this film was made? A shocking death tends to change the conversation. And now we have even more context, unwanted context, even more gravitas. We know Stand By Me was written by Stephen King with a script by Reynold Gideon and Bruce A. Evans, but don't the words feel like Rob Reiner's, especially now? The kindness of Chris wanting Gordy to leave him behind because he's the smart one, the wisdom to know when to give Gordy a hug after they found the body, the courage to stand up to Ace despite the knife at his neck, the way that Chris walks away at the end of the film, fading out to his eventual death. It feels like something only Rob Reiner could have done. But maybe that is the circumstances talking. A shocking death tends to change the conversation. I'm Bo Nicholson, and this is Movieversaries. Yes, this is Movieversary from Punch and Pie Media. I'm Bo Nicholson. This is where we celebrate and sometimes reevaluate some of the greatest movies ever on a significant anniversary. On this episode, we're discussing Stand By Me, a Rob Reiner classic on its 40th anniversary. To help me discuss the film, the very first of 2026, so I want to welcome the audience and also the panel to our new year. This year, we're doing movies that from years that end in six, which feels weird considering where we started. Anyway, first up, I've never had a friend like her. Jesus, has anyone? It's Violet Hammond. Hello, Violet.
Oh, it's just like everybody just trying to make me cry all the time. Hi.
yeah. But it's kind of my MO ever since the Barbie episode when I realized I could make you cry on air. I've been angling for it a fair bit. I've got to be honest. All right, next up, do I think he's weird? Definitely. But so what? Everybody is weird. It's Andy Williams. Hello, Andy.
I knew that was going to be me.
I could have gone with our next guest as well, but I chose to go with, this is his age. He's in the prime of his youth. It's Ian Buckley. Hello, Ian.
Thank you. No, I need to hear that having just turned. Never mind.
Yeah,
that would have worked for me. I'm the youngest of the panel.
I know, but did you need it the most?
That's the thing.
I went with Ian very deliberately there. So welcome everybody to this new season of Movieversaries. How are we feeling? Feeling pumped? Feeling ready?
So ready.
So pumped.
I'm like a bike tire.
Sometimes deflated.
Like. And I'm blowing into them, baby.
Yeah.
We're back, everybody.
Yeah, we're back. Yeah.
2026.
Let's go.
No. Let's talk Stand By Me. In Rob Reiner's classic coming-of-age story, four boys in their early teens set off on a quest to find the dead body of a young boy who has been missing for a few days. They are each an outcast in some way, going through their own tribulations, and this is their chance to be noticed, to be cared about. But they need to beat the local gang of older boys, led by Ace, played by Kiefer Sutherland. It receives one Oscar nomination for the equivalent of Best Adapted Screenplay, losing to A Room with a View. It has a score of 8.1 out of 10 on IMDb, putting it at number 238 on their list of the greatest films ever. It has a Metascore of 75, but the death of River Phoenix means this has become an interesting time capsule to a view of a promising talent, much like watching a James Dean film. Rob Reiner's recent death has made this even more interesting, in my opinion, but what I'd love to know is, what does this film mean to everybody here? And I'll start with Violet.
Well, I was 9 when this came out, so I remember this movie coming out. I don't think I went to see it, but I remember it being on in the house. It was one of those things where we've talked about it before on the show. Like, you'd have HBO or whatever cable channel you had on, and there were the movies that were always on. So I remember this on enough that when TNG came out, Ian, I was like, oh, it's the kid from Stand By Me. So I knew enough to know that, like, oh, it's that kid. Okay, I know who he is. So to the non-Star Trek nerds in the audience, that's Star Trek The Next Generation. So
wondering about TNG.
Yeah, you're like, what's TNG? I'm like staring straight at Ian, like my fellow Star Trek nerd. So yeah, like, I mean, it was on enough, but I don't think this was one of those movies that I reached for, like I would say in E.T. or a Goonies or something more lighthearted. Like, there is humor in this, but it is full of pathos. So I don't know if this was really one of my favorites growing up, but I definitely saw it in that 9 to 10 year old age.
I have a take for you, not from me though, from Alex, and I'll be parking that for a little bit later on, but I wonder if that sort of bleeds into why it wasn't one of your favorites, but we'll touch on that soon. Ian, you were shouted out there by Vi. What does it mean? What does this film mean to you?
So I was almost 1 when this came out, and I,
Mems.
You know, so I definitely didn't, definitely didn't grow up with this. And, you know, I don't really understand why exactly. There were certainly other 80s film. I mean, The Goonies was right there. One that was frequently on in my house as I was a kid. E.T. was in heavy rotation. Like, E.T. was probably like the one for me, but Goonies was in the mix for sure. And I never saw Stand By Me until I was like 35. I mean,
really?
It was just not a part of my childhood. It was one of these touchstones for, it seemed like, everyone
else,
especially here in the States. Like, this is, I mean, I don't know how it translates in Australia or the UK. I'd be interested to learn, but here it feels like this just firmly established piece of Americana that is like a touchstone for everybody. And to that end, even though I had never seen it, I very much felt like I kind of got it. Like, I knew what it was about without having ever seen it. I knew who was in it. That these iconic, you know, that these iconic roles were, you know, played by people who, you know, to Violet's point, like Will Wheaton on TNG, like that was the context in which I was introduced to Will Wheaton. It wasn't this. And it was sort of funny to like go back and see, oh my God, like he did this before he ever did Next Generation. And he was so young in that, like to see these incredible kid performances. And they are, I mean, that is, I think is another one of the legacies of this movie, is that it gets a lot of good young performances out of these kids, and it feels like one of those movies where if you're growing up, you're seeing these kids who are like your age as you're watching the movie, and it, like, you know, it just has that feeling of, you know, authenticity. It just feels like a very lived in movie. It feels like, even though it's set in like the 50s or whatever, And maybe our generation is the last to have had this experience. Like, I remember, like, maybe not exactly 12. Middle school was a bit of a social valley for me in my life. But, you know, in elementary school, like, I remember running around with my friends in our neighborhood and just, you know, going out for hours, just wandering, doing whatever. Like, I don't think that exists anymore. Like, at all. I mean, I don't have kids. You know, Vi, you can speak to this, but, like, I don't know anyone who has this kind of experience anymore. Not the dead body thing, but like that sense of adventure with your friends. Like, there's a reason why so many kids and young adults and even people who are 35 seeing it for the first time, like myself, like really connect to this film.
Andy, how does it translate to you as you're slightly younger, born in the early 90s? I imagine you saw this a while ago, but as a UK person as well, like Ian was mentioning.
Well, so I first watched this in my sort of late teens. I was beginning to get aware of directors and beginning to get aware of filmmaking in general. And when I saw that this director went on this phenomenal run of films that I had seen, films like Spinal Tap, films like Princess Bride, I was like, okay, let's fill in those gaps. You're probably talking to the wrong person on how it translates, because like I am already in the bag for sort of small town Americana stories. Like that's one of the sort of subgenres of literature or cinema that I really love. And I think that stems back to things like To Kill a Mockingbird, even from when I was a kid. So yeah, I have a relatively long standing relationship, I guess, with the film. But I've only seen it like two or three times. It's not like a cultural touchstone. People have definitely heard of it. I don't think everyone would go, oh yeah, I've seen that. It's one of my favorite movies, that sort of thing.
That's fascinating. So we've actually managed to curate an audience of four people here that don't really consider this like one of those movies, one of like the absolute favorite growing up movies, which seems like it feels like an unusual experience. I've already mentioned in my intro my experience of watching it for the first time at school, you know, lazy day for the teacher, wheel the fucking TV in and let's put this on and shut the kids up for 2 hours, not even 2 hours. I liked it. I've always liked it, but it was never a favorite for me either. I've probably watched it twice, maybe three times as well. And I don't know. I'll probably go back to the Americans on this one. Being such an American movie, and it does feel extremely American, is it unusual to have this many people of our age in a conversation and like none of them think Stand By Me is like one of their favorites?
You'd probably get like one person who would be like, yeah, it's my absolute favorite movie. But
yeah,
I don't know anyone who really would go to bat for this being their number one favorite. I haven't shown it to my kids. And that's kind of one of my like thing. Like, I mean, we've talked about like the movies you can't wait to show your kids. Back to the Future episode was like a big part of that. How Andy and I couldn't wait to show Back to the Future to our kids.
Yeah.
I don't know how they would take this. Like, my son is 13. It was really interesting to watch this with a 13-year-old boy in my life. And be looking at these boys and be like, my kid would not be able to survive past the backyard. To like, to the point of kids don't, to the point of like, kids don't do this anymore. They don't. Like, there's no way. Like, if it's not connected to a PlayStation, they're not going to be out doing anything. So this is like very much a time capsule of a very different time that ended in the late 80s, early 90s, in terms of kids running around.
Yeah, that feels universal, doesn't it? Like, not just America, but
yeah,
the kids aren't running around like they used to. And if they do, we're kind of terrified of them. Like, we're like, oh, that's a gang. It's a gang of 12-year-olds. They're going to stab me.
I was even thinking it the opposite direction. I was thinking about all the parents who are afraid to leave their kids out of their sight. Like, the thought, helicopter the idea parents, of...
Yeah.
I can't not know where they are at all times. Like, just people would look at you like you're crazy if you suggested that they just like not know where their kids are for a while and see Absolutely. How that feels.
Because we grew up with movies like this.
Right. Right.
We saw what happens. And I think
a knife to the throat, gun to the face.
That was just Kiefer Sutherland getting an Uber.
Right. All these normal parts of an American childhood. And I think for me, and maybe this is because I didn't come to it until later in life, like, I think this plays much better to an adult who has had time to reflect back on, like, the sentiments in this movie, the things that really, really, you know, there are a few things that do hit me like a ton of bricks in this movie, and I don't know if they would be the same things if I was watching this as a kid. Like, looking back with regret or, I don't know, some complex ball of emotions about like, man, like me and that kid were so close for those years. And we had these, like these core memories, you know, to go back to these like core memory idea, these core memories of my life, of my childhood, whatever. And like, I haven't spoken to those guys in 30 years, you know, like they're just... Yeah. That is a perspective that I wouldn't have even been able to have as a kid. Like, maybe it would have been interesting if I'd seen this as a kid and wondered like, huh, I wonder if that thing will happen to me someday. And yeah, spoiler alert, young Ian, it does. It happens to you time and time again. You have these people who come into your life for different stretches of time who might be like an incredible like friend for a short stretch of time, but you have these indelible moments in your life that are tied to these people who, you know, you don't know how long they're going to stay in your life. I'm fortunate that I have some friends who are still in my life from like high school, but like there's one or two of those and the rest are like more recent friends and everyone else has kind of fallen by the wayside, including people who I thought would be in my life forever. And those emotions that this movie taps into, those things, those experiences are what to me connect me to this movie when I do watch it as an adult. That said, it doesn't have that kind of, you know, I saw it for the first time 5 years ago. This was my second viewing. And while I really, really did appreciate and connect to a lot about it, it doesn't feel like it's going to be in that like upper pantheon of American films for me personally, even though I really like it. I think this is a movie that a lot of people really like when they see it. But yeah, it may not be in that upper echelon for them.
Violet and Ian touched on something there, Andy. And you sort of mentioned you haven't shown your kids either. And maybe is it maybe like slightly too old for your kids? Is that the vibe?
So,
or do you think maybe it won't translate as well because of its time period or something?
I think it's more that the age thing. I was weighing up whether to watch it with my eldest or not. Bear in mind, my eldest is 10.
So like almost maybe.
Well, but then when I watched, because it'd been a while since I'd seen it, so I thought, you know what, let me check this out. And, you know, some of the language, some of the the imagery where you've got the children smoking, you've got them with guns, you've got them with knives, and, you know, I don't think he's ready to see depictions of children in that way yet. So I'm glad that I didn't. I wouldn't be adverse to having that conversation with him in a few years' time. I wouldn't be adverse to sitting down and watching this film with him then. It's just, I think it would translate in that regard, but I just think the age thing is, that's too much.
It's extremely mid-80s in a lot of ways. Mm. Like, Violet, you mentioned the feeling of watching this movie knowing you have a 13-year-old boy, you know, probably in his room yelling at people on the internet playing PlayStation or Xbox. But
both.
Both. but like, I assume he's not like, you know, a chain smoker who calls people homophobic or ableist slurs. And if he did, he needs to wrap around the head. But it's very different for kids now.
Hey there, 50s dad.
Yeah. I'll send him to the moon. I'll send him to the moon. You know?
To the moon, Alice.
Is this the same moon that you're going to throw a lasso around?
What do you want, Mary? Do you want the moon?
Oh boy.
we'll cover that one actually this year. I'm excited about that.
Spoiler
Christmas
alert.
Time. Yeah. Yeah, it does feel very different. I guess when I watched it this time, and I talked about this in the intro, I couldn't help but, like, part of the reason why this is the first movie we're covering this year is the untimeliness of the death of Rob Reiner and how recent it was and how in the culture it still probably just feels. Like, people are probably starting to process the death a bit by now, but it's still, like, it really rocked people. People who maybe even weren't like film heads were like really, really rocked by this.
Yeah.
In very much the same way that River Phoenix's death rocked people in the 90s, people that weren't necessarily film heads knew about this tragic, horrible death, this untimely death of, what was he, like 23 or something? It was like.
Yeah, it was 23.
Yeah, like unbelievable stuff, you know? And I guess I couldn't detach the legacy of the film from watching it, you know, like I couldn't help, but I couldn't take my eyes off Chris, River Phoenix's character. Like, I know that Gordy's the main character, but like everything that Chris did, I was noticing like little tiny details, a shift of the eyes or a hesitation, a beat that he takes or a repeated word because he's flustered or passionate, you know, like all these little choices I was noticing very, very obviously, where I wasn't noticing Will Wheaton's performance, which kind of snuck up on me a bit. You know, Jerry O'Connell, Kangaroo Jack legend. I'm gonna that's our Australian attachment to him.
Joe's apartment legend.
Joe's apartment legend.
Joe's apartment.
singing cockroach movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what a
Mr.
What
Rebecca
a great...
Romain to you.
Yes, exactly.
what a career he's had. Jerry. I mean, Corey Feldman's in here
Slider.
Too, you know. I don't know how well it holds up in a lot of ways. I think in that way, it has like this gravitas that's really, really interesting, but also homophobic slurs and ableist slurs and the fat phobia.
Yes.
And all of this stuff is kind of crazy. And I'm not sure if I know the R word is making a comeback shamefully to the culture, the ableist slur, but I think kids these days would actually kind of look at this and be like at arm's length almost.
Yeah.
In a way.
I think my daughter would have a hard time with this. I don't know if she would really get into this. I think her her outrage at those things would really keep her from enjoying the other aspects of the movie. Because I've seen it happen with her with other things. So,
yeah.
I think is my son would probably like it more than her, I'm pretty sure.
Is there also the idea that there are no female characters, really? Like, it just completely dismisses... Because it is a film about male friendships and how boys transform as they grow.
Yes.
Do you think that could be a stumbling block for you and Daisy?
I don't know. I think that she would be fine with that aspect of it because one of her discoveries this year, another movie that I was nervous to show her because I thought she would get really upset about it, and she did, but she loved it, was Dead Poets Society, which is another movie that is very focused on boys and boys, how they interact with each other, how they learn from a mentor, how they grow up, how they deal with their depression, how they don't deal with their depression, etc. So that movie, which I thought would absolutely break her heart, it did, but in a way that she absolutely loves it and has rewatched it several times on her own. So I don't think that just the boy aspect of it would keep her from it, but I think all of the fat phobia, the slurs, the language, a lot of the things that go on, I think would really cause her to pull back in a way that she wouldn't be as immersed in it as she was with Dead Poets Society.
I think that is another reason why it struck me as something that resonates more with me from an adult perspective. You know, I can contextualize the language in it and not like... Obviously, I'm not a fan of it, but, you know, I don't allow that to bounce me out of appreciating and analyzing what is here that isn't that. And there's a lot there thematically that I also think is just more geared towards adults. Like, there are definitely some moments that I think would be really interesting to see a young person about the age of these boys process. I think the scene with Chris where he's talking about that teacher who stole that money. And like, I think it is really important for kids of any gender, you know, to go through the experience, as difficult as it can be. It's important to learn from it, of having an adult in your life let you down. And hopefully not in a way that is too traumatic and too problematic, but like, I think a situation like this, where this is a relatively safe way for this child to learn a really valuable lesson, like, those things are interesting, could be interesting as a person of the same age to watch and to analyze and think about on their own. But there's a lot here that's really for people who have lived a little bit more life than these kids have. And it's about reflection. I mean, the Richard Dreyfuss character, like the bookend of that person finding out about Chris as an adult and then writing about this experience as an adult and narrating at points throughout and having some really poignant observations about life that have a much broader view and perspective than these kids can have at this point. Like, I think it's a movie for adults more than it is for kids at the end of the day.
Just to put a pin in what I said earlier, Vi, about Alex's take was very much about, like, there was no way in for her because this is a movie about boys being boys, like, being extremely macho about this, like, this posturing, and like, she just didn't find it interesting. She found the movie impossibly slow. Like, she was just like, oh, that was a really slow movie, and I'm like, are you kidding me? It's like 83 minutes or something.
Yeah,
but like but she just couldn't get into it. There was no way in for her. So I just wanted to circle back to that, because I did mention I was going to. I'd love to talk about the themes of the film, because while it does have some issues, like we pointed out, I think the themes are really interesting. Ian touched on one just there. Andy and Violet, you both have kids that are boys, particularly, that are like 13 and 10, right? This is a very interesting age for these kids. They're about to, and like, for the men in the room, yes, the fat phobia, homophobia, ableist language is horrific, but it is also freaking exactly how kids acted at certain points. Like, I remember being 13 and being a part of this bullshit and regretting it, or seeing some of the bullshit that was even more extreme and hating it. I've always hated ableism, for example, because of my brother having a disability and seeing the way that those kids got teased. You know, that was a real trigger point for me, whereas I didn't worry as much about fat phobia, and that's regrettable. You know, but we were kids and we were 13, we were dipshits and we were trying to be macho and all this bravado around our mates and like who's got the biggest dick and all that sort of stuff. When you're 13, you've all got pin dicks, like shut up. But you know what I mean? But I think this film does touch on some interesting stuff. Ian talks about, you know, the adults that let you down. This film's full of that. You know, you got Gordy's dad, who's a real piece of work.
What a shithead.
Yeah.
What a shithead. Gordy's older brother. What a great older brother to have. What a great example that an older sibling can be for a younger sibling. The only female character that I can think of, apart from the lady that runs out of the shop being like, who let off the cherry bombs? Apart from her, there's like Gordy's mum at the lunch table, like silently acknowledges Gordy when the dad's ignoring him. That's it. Like there's like, like she passes him the potato when he asks for it.
Those were the good times.
Yeah.
Like that was her level of engagement before the death.
Yes, and that's right.
You can only imagine how much worse it's gotten.
She's just standing there like a ghost. Yeah. She's standing there at the laundry line, just like catatonic.
But what I really loved as a theme for this movie was the friendship. The fact that there are boys, like it's trying to like, yes, it shows the unhealthy part of being a boy, the fat phobia, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. But it also shows an ideal, healthy version of that, which is Chris, where Chris is the kind of friend that knows when to give Gordy a hug or when to sit there and say, I fucking wish I was your dad because I wouldn't let you say this stupid shit. Like, you have so much ability. Like, leave this shit behind. Like, go be you. You know, your dad doesn't even know you. He doesn't hate you. He doesn't even know you. You know, all that sort of stuff. Andy, these themes are so important to instill in our younger generation, you know, in these kids. And I really admired that about this movie.
Yeah. It's the idea of children and their fathers and sons and their fathers in particular. And it's impossible when you're talking about a Rob Reiner film to then not acknowledge the fact that his father was Carl Reiner. Mm. He had to kind of step out of the shadow of this extremely well-known comedian. So the fact that they've shifted the story from being about four boys to being there is one main character and his three friends, I think that's key. For me, it says a lot about what Rob Reiner wanted to tell with this story. I know he doesn't, he hasn't written the screenplay or anything like that, but he definitely had a hand or two in that. But I think it's all about the way that Gordy processes his grief. It's all about the way that he's finding his place in life. And grief comes to different people in different ways. And the way that he has dealt with it is by not becoming emotional, kind of shutting off. And that's why going to see the body is so important for him. But the lessons that you've got in sort of strength of friendships, like I never had friends like this growing up. I never had those friends that were so unabashedly always in your corner. They're really good friends, but no one would have said or did what Chris said.
No, that's an adult's wisdom.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But it plays in the movie and it plays really, really well. But I think that, again, that's playing to us as an older audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've touched on something, and I thought you were going to touch on something different. When you talk about Rob Reiner's story, you talk about like, well, he is the son of Carl Reiner. Geez, isn't Rob Reiner's entire story now definitely locked in to being about fathers and sons?
Oh,
Like especially with what we know now, right? And isn't that just something? Just I'll just put that right there.
And he had such a famously loving relationship with Carl. I mean, you know, he told a story probably multiple times, but I remember him saying that, you know, when he was a kid, he went up to his parents and asked them if he could change his name. And at first they were upset that he wanted to change his like last name or something like that. And, you know, he was just a little kid who wanted to change his name to his father's name because he loved his dad so much. Mm. Like, you know, they just like this charming, close relationship. And I would imagine that some of, you know, Rob Reiner's energy in painting the father character in the show, in this movie, I don't remember the name of Gordy's father, but, you know, is as such a villain, really. I mean, he's this, you know, without being actively abusive, he's such a neglectful, disconnected, distant father from his one remaining child, who is also going through this loss. And, you know, all that poor Gordy can play in his mind is a vision of his dad saying, you know, wrong kid died.
And should have been you.
It should have been you. Yeah, it's horrible. And I would imagine that that's, you know, for Rob Reiner directing this adaptation of a Stephen King novella, like that's the horror for him at the heart of this story is the damage that is wrought by neglectful adults.
I had issues with the dad's performance, but I the more I think about it, the more I'm just like, no, I think he was meant to be like cartoonishly bad as a villain, but also just as a performer. Like the way that he sits there and says, why can't you be more like Danny, like, you know, have friends like Danny or whatever, but like I just did it with more animation than he did, right? Like his performance was very like stunted and wooden.
Flat.
Yeah. And I feel like obviously his character is meant to be flat. He's going through grief, but there was a disconnect there for me, which kind of leads me into let's talk about performances. Let's put a spotlight right there. Mm. We've mentioned The Boys.
Yes.
River Phoenix. I adore this performance. I don't know if this is like an uncommon feeling. I think it's a pretty commonly held one that he is just such a star. He works. I believe everything he's saying. You know, he's so good. And I think the choice to have them play the same age, but he's like 15 or 16 in real life, and like Jerry O'Connell's like 10 or 11.
Yeah, he was 11.
Yeah, you know, like he's very obviously bigger and stronger and more mature looking. I think it works. You know, like I like it. I'd love to talk about the performances. So, Vi, go for it. What are your feelings about the overall cast?
Well, to go into River Phoenix and how Chris is portrayed in this, it's like I had written down under themes, actually, that tragedy and trauma makes kids grow up fast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Gordy's trauma is recent. You know, Denny just died in a car accident. This is like a very recent thing. But Chris has been an abused child for his entire life. So it makes sense to me that he is like the voice of reason, and he seems so much older because he's been forced to grow up so fast because of everything that's happened to him. So, and instead of lashing out at people, he has turned that into the way he takes care of his friends. And it's not just Gordy, like the way that he gets Corey Feldman off the train track.
Yeah.
That scene jumped out to me more in this than I can ever remember on any watch. Like he is desperately trying to protect his friends, and then the minute it's over, give me skin. Like he needs, you know, I need to reforge his friendship with you. I wasn't doing it to say that you weren't, you know, strong or tough. I was doing it because I needed to help you. Like everything that he does in this movie is to help his friend group. And it's just so powerful. His performance is unbelievably powerful in this.
Yeah.
As a character, that also speaks to his ending as well. Like he dies stopping a bar
fight. Trying to save people. Yeah.
So I think Chris as a character has that savior sort of within him because no one came for him. No one helped him. Yep. So he now has to try and pass that on to everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, I believe it. Like, yes, a lot of what he's saying is written by an adult and it's very adult wisdom, but I don't know. He sells it. Yeah. He sells it.
He absolutely does.
Yeah. Yeah. Even the things that feel like they are coming from someone who has wisdom beyond their years. I mean, like you said, the lived experience obviously mm-hmm. ages one prematurely when it's that extreme, but also he's still kind of framing things in a way that a kid might believably frame them. Like, I know what he means, but also fundamentally saying like, I wish I could be your dad is still kind of a weird thing to say to your friend. Like, it's mm-hmm. like, it's a thing that I could believe a kid would say. It doesn't sound like something an adult would say, even though the point he's making is a very sage, wise point, even though he's very much taking on like a caretaking role. Like, it yeah. is still coming through time and time again that this is a child, and it is a child who has had to develop at an accelerated rate because of the circumstances of their life, but still very believable as a child.
It's that acceptance of the world doesn't care who you are. It's him acknowledging and understanding in the film that his place in the world has already been decided by his circumstances and things outside of his control. So he can be intelligent, intellectually, emotionally, but also because of the way that he's grown up and the class system in which he's grown up, the world has decided who he is. Mm. And I think River Phoenix portrays that with a real sense of, in that scene, that's the kind of the one scene where he loses his composure. But throughout the rest of the film, there's a real stillness to him. There's a real anchoring presence to the group.
The interesting thing about siblings is that siblings often end up being quite different people. And it's a very confusing thing because there's a whole nature versus nurture argument. And I feel like nurture plays like a big role. And it's very confusing for people because they're like, well, they had the same parents. How do they end up being so different? And Sentimental Value touches on this really well, actually, where like one of the characters just said, well, it's different because I had you. You know, I had the older sibling that could do this or whatever. Chris doesn't have that. He has an older sibling. It's Eyeball. And we have a glimpse into what Chris's future could be if he goes down this road. Eyeball is like this loser that's part of the Cobras group that follows everything that Kiefer Sutherland's Ace says. It was interesting to see the involvement of the Cobras in this movie because I think a big part of me feels like, oh, it's kind of like an unnecessary diversion in a lot of ways. It just adds tension inorganically. So I wondered if there was like a criticism there in my brain or whether we kind of needed to see like this is the path the boys could take. Because in a small town like this, if you don't have the talent to get out, like this is you, right? Mm-hmm. Andy, you mentioned the Uber story of Kiefer Sutherland. If you haven't heard that one, read the news. That one's, he's assaulted an Uber driver, allegedly. The last couple of days. But how do we feel about the Cobras? Like, and especially maybe Kiefer Sutherland as Ace. Andy, we haven't heard from you for a moment.
Well, he's menacing, right? He's deeply worrisome. Like, he's the character you never want to be left alone with. And I think that the way Sutherland performs that, he showed it when in things like The Lost Boys as well. He has a real air of menace about him. And it's something that later on in his career, he has subverted massively with things like 24 and Designated Survivor. But I think that the gang as a whole, I understand where you're coming from. Like, when we're away from the boys and we're with the Cobras, we just want to get back the boys. We want to see the central relationships. But I think you're right. Like, I've not read the story. I've not actually read any Stephen King. Has anyone read the original novella?
Violet's Waving?
Yep, I have. Yeah.
Are the Aces in
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, and okay, and the characters come up in other Stephen King stories because he is the Stephen King universe where,
okay,
you know, yeah.
And
so Ace is in multiple stories.
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah.
Is the framing device the same as well? It's an older writer looking back. Okay.
It's the same framing device, but the movie does definitely steer more toward Gordy, even though adult Gordy is telling the story somewhat, or the author is telling the story of Gordy. But
it always bothers me when Stephen King writes about writers.
Yeah, well,
it feels lazy.
I mean, I hope they didn't go find a dead body, but this is basically, you know, he wept at the end of this movie because this is basically like him and his friends. This was like his love letter to the friends he had when he was 12. So this, you know, so this worked for him in a big way. That whole, it's part of a collection called Different Seasons, and it has The Body, which became Stand By Me. It has Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption, which became The Shawshank Redemption. It has Apt Pupil, which was also filmed as Apt Pupil. And then my favorite story in it is the only one that hasn't become a movie, and that one's called The Breathing Method. And they're all excellent. It's an excellent book.
So I've heard.
Yeah, I mean, it's really great. I went through a period, I want to say like 12 to 15, where I read everything that he had written up till that point. I've fallen off a bit, but I read most of his stuff. Yeah.
I'm exactly the opposite. I don't think I've ever picked up a King, but I started trying to listen to the audiobook of The Stand, which was like 30 hours long. So I tapped out of that.
Yes.
Hey, buddy.
that's like the draft episode.
I was into it for the first maybe like 3 hours.
Not to sound like a specific clown, not Pennywise, but a different clown. You want to play a game?
Ooh.
Sure.
You just want to play a game? So basically, I haven't done my research, listeners. And very deliberately so this time. It's kind of got born out of the fact that we were going to record last week. I didn't have enough time to research. And I said, hey, guys, why don't you pick one fact each and see if who can like win me over with the most interesting fact about this movie. And I promise that I won't look. And then we postponed a week and I still haven't done the research. I kept my word. So the only research
I did. It's been a lot of effort for you.
Oh, it was so hard. You know, so difficult. So I have a wheel here with three names on it, Violet, Ian, and Andy. I'm going to spin this wheel and whoever goes first gets the first pick of whatever fact they want to tell me, and then second, and then third. And then at the end of that, whoever wins gets a cheer from the children of the spoil. Does that sound good?
Yay.
Ooh.
Okay, spinning the wheel.
I can think of no greater prize.
The first fact, you wouldn't believe it. Oh, is it going to tick over? Violet.
Oh, come on.
She did it. She won.
Okay, Vine, what's your first fact?
Oh, this is
Try not to salt the boys' game if you can.
No, okay, so this is hard because I asked before we started, dear listeners, I asked for a clarification of the rules. Am I giving all my facts or just the best one?
Just the one. And hopefully Ian and Andy have a backup.
All right, well, I have some if the boys don't have any, but I'm going to very specifically, this is very similar to the draft, Andy. I'm not going to do one of these because I think it might be the one that you have.
Okay.
So I'm going to hold it. And I'm really sorry, but I'm going to do the Star Trek one, Ian. I love you. Okay, so all the Star Trek connections here. So Will Wheaton, obviously, we've already touched on the fact that he was in The Next Generation. But also, Jerry O'Connell is the first officer. He is Ransom on Lower Decks. He's the voice. Okay. So we have two Star Trek guys. But as Ian has also already mentioned, he's married to Rebecca Romijn, who is the first officer in Star Trek Strange New Worlds. So now we have all this Star Trek stuff. But to bring it back to Stand By Me, that's Rebecca Romijn's number one favorite movie in the world. and she did not tell her husband this. Her college friends ratted her out and told her husband that she had posters of the movie on her walls in college. It's her number one favorite movie. And they made her look silly in front of her husband.
Do you know why she didn't tell her husband? I don't know this for a fact, but
this is just a guess.
She was in love with River Phoenix.
No,
she wasn't in love with Jerry O'Connell.
Jerry O'Connell. He's so cute in this movie, though. He's such a little cutie.
He is adorable. He is
also, like, unrecognizable.
Oh, I know.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this in a shaming way. He just looks very different as a child. I mean, he just did. I guess, unfortunately, we don't really have River Phoenix to compare to. But, of course, like, I feel like Will Wheaton kind of looks basically like a little kid version of adult Will Wheaton. Like,
yes,
there is a very straight line from A to B there.
Corey Feldman, same thing.
Jerry O'Connell's been on a different journey.
He most definitely has.
All right, good start, Vi. I hope that hasn't ruined things for Ian specifically. I'm going to spin the wheel again and see who's going next. It is Andy. Andy, you are going next.
Okay. So, there we go. I get a little clap as well.
Yeah, how nice.
Mm-hmm.
So, they originally weren't going to have the Ben E. King version of Stand By Me over the end credits. As we know, the film was already, it was called The Body originally. Rob Reiner suggested Stand By Me because the Ben E. King song fit it perfectly. Some clever person at the studio decided that they needed it to be a single. So they needed someone to record it. And that person was Michael Jackson.
Oh.
So we very nearly had a Michael Jackson version of Stand By Me on the end credits as opposed to the original Ben E. King. Mm-hmm. Rob Reiner put paid to that.
Oh, interesting. And then sort of eventually they got the rights for the original, because you do hear it wasn't the right credits, thing.
It wasn't the right thing. It was a
creative choice. What a baffling creative choice.
Yeah, talk about anachronistic. Like, that would have been very tonally so different.
Yeah,
you end that on that beautiful shot of River Phoenix fading in, and then you just hear hee hee. Like, no, thank you.
Well, that story was worth it just to hear your Michael Jackson impersonation. That's
it doesn't come out very often.
No, good.
Imagine that.
No reason why.
Just throwing it into daily life. Just like,
hey, just picking up the groceries.
Ow!
who left this mud on the floor, and then you're just like pointing to your son, be like, he did.
No.
Anyway, that was really bad.
If I disagree,
where's the no button?
If I disagree with people in a bar, I just go up going, "Wanna be starting something?"
Oh my gosh!
Want to unsubscribe from these comments?
As long as you stay away from the pretty young things, Andy. All right, let's finish with Ian.
All right, bringing it home. So mine isn't trivia per se, largely because I forgot to do this, but. It does bring me back to a point that I neglected to make earlier that I want to kind of bring up again. But the scene where the kids actually do arrive at the body. Now, I'd known that the movie involved the kids on a search to see this dead body, but I honestly, gun to my head, couldn't remember, you know, the first time I ever saw this, whether they actually successfully found the body. And so the scene struck me as, again, just another reminder that this is a film that in many ways, not just the language, but thematically and experientially is I think, aimed more at adults, but they don't shy away from showing us that dead kid. And it does, I think, have a weight to it that the film wants it to have. Like, it wants that moment, these kids to feel that moment. And by not shying away from showing the audience too, from allowing us to share in that moment, I think it really adds this impactful, somber note to this, what has more or less been an adventure tale up to this point. And I really appreciated that, you know, kind of, again, like, mature note that the film was striking than I might have otherwise expected. And I, you know, my little tiny bit of trivia there is that apparently I was reading a little bit about the production of the movie. The Rob Reiner wanted the kids to have a very kind of genuine reaction. And so, you know, the moment that is captured of them seeing the body for the first time was in fact the first moment that the actors saw the prop. It was revealed to them in that moment, and the reaction captured was their genuine reaction to seeing that. And I just really appreciated that note of, you know, authenticity that the film struck there.
Yeah, I like that too. I love when movies do stuff like that. I thought your trivia for a bit there was going to be like, and so they deliberately arranged the body of Ray Brower into a swastika.
Oh, no.
Because he kind of does look a bit like a... No, but he didn't, obviously. No neo-Nazi dog whistles, I should hope.
No, they just straight up killed a kid. That was my trivia. They just fucking...
Oh, my God.
They just fucking murdered a kid.
Oh, jeez.
Okay. I wouldn't award that just out of principle. I liked all three of those. I am going to announce a winner, though. The one that perhaps shocked me the most was Andy Williams with the Michael Jackson Stand By Me. So, hooray! Well done, Andy Williams. You get the prize you so desperately sought. Congratulations.
I'm thrilled.
Thank you all for that.
I have three more.
I have one
Please.
More.
So, Violet, don't forget.
Okay, but are your children
one out of me? So that's it.
They're fine. Don't worry.
Are your children starving, Violet? Like,
no, they're
fine. Last we heard, they were starving children waiting for their dinner. But surely they can. One of them's an adult.
One of them is an adult. Yes. So what? No. They know what I'm doing, and then I'm going to cook. We're good. This is the one I thought you were going to do.
You're cooking now.
Because let me cook. So when the boys add up all their money, they come up with $2.37. That's a Stephen King Easter egg. It's 237.
237, yeah.
Yes. So Stephen. 237 pops up in a lot of his books, but most notably in The Shining.
Wait, isn't it 217?
It's supposed to be 237. It's 237 in the book.
No, it's 237 in the movie.
I don't know what it is. I know that it's a Stephen King.
Whatever
Easter
it is, it's this number, apparently.
It's this number, and they purposely made the money add up to $2.37 so that it could have 237.
Well, that's cool. That's cool. I like that.
I'm glad they did that research, because the movie is set in the entirely wrong state, because when they were reading the novella, they thought they meant Portland, Oregon, not Portland, Maine. So this is the only Stephen King adaptation that is not in Maine, because everything is in Maine. And it's because they read it wrong.
Great.
Very funny.
Supposed to be Maine. This movie started, and I haven't seen it in forever. And I literally was like, what the hell are we doing in Oregon? Like, every Stephen King story is in Maine.
See, I can't tell the difference.
Wrong Portland. Oh, like,
did
Maine.
Did they say Oregon?
They say Oregon several times at the beginning. Yes.
Okay.
They're in Oregon, and it is Castle Rock, Maine, in the novella, because everything Stephen King is set in the state of Maine.
So is Castle Rock the Rob Reiner production company?
Correct.
Castle Rock, Oregon?
Yes.
He took Castle Rock from Stand By Me, but it should be Castle Rock, Maine.
But in the novella, it's
Maine.
Maine. Yeah.
Yes. But, you know, they didn't know that there was a Portland, Maine. They assumed Portland, Oregon. Because they mentioned at one point being close to Portland.
So Castle Rock's like a real place?
I don't think so.
Okay, it's so they made up a real place.
Stephen King made up Castle Rock.
It's a place in the King universe. Just like
the Dark Tower universe is a town
in King. It's not a real town in Maine, though.
Yeah, right. Okay. It's a town in his stuff. And then my last one, poor Ray Brower. But I never knew or never noticed that Ray Brower is at the pie eating contest. He's standing behind the twins.
Oh. Is that a deliberate thing?
He had one moment. I don't know. I've never noticed it and I never heard it talked about, but I found it when I was searching for trivia. The actor is supposed to be Ray Brower in the story. He is attending the pie eating contest before his untimely demise.
Kind of like an Easter egg, seeing Tim Curry at the start of Rocky Horror Picture Show at the wedding.
At the wedding, yes.
Looking the wrong way at a wall.
Just turning around and staring at a wall, yes.
Okay. Okay, cool. I like that. Like little Easter eggs. Andy, yes. You had another one?
I do.
You've already won.
Yeah, I know. But give us it. I'd love trivia.
Well, this was my scrambling if I had to back up. Allegedly, Jerry O'Connell caused the production to shut down for a day because he accidentally ate brownies from a state fair that were laced with marijuana.
I almost mentioned this one.
Yep. Yeah. I know this one too. Yeah, they couldn't find him. This poor kid wandered off.
This 11-year-old kid went off and ate some space cake.
Yeah. Oh, and he's 11. He wouldn't have stopped at one.
No.
If he got access to them without people noticing, he might have had several.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently
I think they found him crying
A couple hours later. Yeah.
Yeah. This poor baby.
Oh, gosh. That is something. That is something. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, congratulations, Andy, on your win.
Yes.
I like this little mini game. I like it. I don't know. There's something about it. Let's talk favorites while we're in the ballpark. Favorite scenes.
How do you not say the campfire? The campfire is iconic. It really is.
What is Goofy? Goofy's a cow. What are we talking about?
No, just Goofy's the way. Goofy is a
Goofy's
dog.
Not a dog.
Goofy's a definitely cow. A dog.
Goofy's a dog. He's not a Pluto dog because Pluto is domesticated. Yeah. He's a humanoid dog.
Okay, I'm typing this into Google. What?
Go right ahead. What is
just
Goofy?
Just like Donald Duck is a duck, but there are also ducks in the universe.
Precisely.
He's a dog? Oh, what the hell? He looks like a cow to me.
He's a dog. He's not clearly. Clarabelle. Clarabelle looks like a cow. When she's walking around, you know she's a cow.
I will point out that he is voiced by a human.
What? So,
okay.
So.
As opposed to Scooby-Doo.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good scene. Bye. Why is it your favorite?
I think that it's the moment of the movie that is the most unabashedly and unashamedly kid-like. Like, it's very childlike conversations. It's a conversation I can imagine, you know, hearing my kids have, that it feels very much like that. There's other moments throughout the movie where you have those kind of very kid-like moments, but that's like an extended scene of it without their lives in peril or any other shenanigans. So the campfire is great. If we're going to talk about other dialogue, then it's just the Mighty Mouse is a cartoon, Superman's a real guy. There's no way a cartoon could beat up a real guy. Had me on the floor. It's so funny.
Andy, favorite scene.
I also had the campfire scene written down. It feels to me like the moment that Gordy begins to grow up.
Mm.
So you've got all of the tension within Chris. The entire time he's been the anchor I mentioned earlier. But he just erodes in the scene. Mm-hmm. His voice tightens, then cracks. He fights his tears and then they come. And Gordy doesn't try to fix the problem. He doesn't give him platitude. He just believes him. And it's the first time where anyone has treated Chris as someone whose future is not already written.
Mm.
So what we're getting is Gordy learning the power of witnessing without rescuing, which is something that defines a writer, I think.
Hmm. Interesting mm-hmm. observation. Something that I could probably learn, actually. I'm a bit of a rescuer. It's just like a natural instinct. Like, oh, I've got to help my friends. But yeah, you know, right. Like there is like a power to like being there.
Just being there.
Mm. Ian, favorite scenes?
Yeah, just a yes and what you were just saying. The very act of being present without inserting myself into the situation, trying to rescue, trying to save, might be the best thing for them. Like allowing myself to accept that sometimes not doing immediately might be what they need from me in that moment is something that I have really struggled to to learn, because I always want to swoop in and help and what can I do? And, you know, I hear you, man. I get that. I struggle with that too. And I think for me, the, you know, going back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, what would I hope a young person of these boys' age who is watching this movie today, like what would I hope they could take away from it that is positive? And I think the moments where these boys, Chris and Gordy, each, you know, they have these moments where they break down in front of the other and are very, very vulnerable, and no one is made fun of for it. Like no one is even gently teased or mocked, or there's no shit talking. No one's a fucking pussy. You know, when someone's actually crying, no one's saying that word that they're so quick to say throughout every other conversation they're having. There's this, you know, for whatever we might struggle with as far as being an audience and like bouncing off of these 13-year-old boys acting and sounding like 13-year-old boys, like the fact that they're also showing that they can be vulnerable and open with their friends, with their boy, with their fellow male, you know, friends, and that is okay. Like that is something that I would want my kids to see modeled in media. Like that is something that I would want kids to see and to know is okay. So for me, those scenes, those moments with those two characters, especially where there's this openness and vulnerability and it's not shamed, I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, I will echo that. I can't really pick out one. I think it's mostly right. When those two are doing that stuff for each other. Yeah, mostly from Chris to Gordy, but Gordy grows into it, like you said, Andy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that's my favorite element of the movie for sure. Before we get to MVPs, I would love to just tick off one of our little catchphrases. Is it capital G great? Vi.
I'm struggling with this a little bit. I don't know if it's capital G great. I mean, it's great, but it might be lowercase g great for me.
Like 4-star great?
Yeah, I think it's like 4-star great. Like, I mean, like I said, this is not probably going to be a movie I reach for when I'm in that like 80s nostalgia mood. There's a lot to recommend here. It's a good watch. Has a really, really good performances. It has some great lines of dialogue. And, you know, I mean, I think honestly what's holding me back, and it's like the silliest little thing, but, and also like, please, I have cried personally over Rob Reiner several times. Like, I don't think I've cried over a famous person since Robin Williams, but like I have shed tears for this man. So what I'm about to say is not to say that I don't love Rob Reiner. But as far as directing children goes, in this movie, there's an instance of someone who does it the best. and then someone who does it the worst. And the worst scene is where I'm having a hard time saying this is capital G great. The way he does it the best is that scene at the campfire where River Phoenix was having a hard time finding it. And he pulled him aside and said, I want you to think about a time in your life that an adult let you down. And encouraged right. him to look at his own feelings and find it in like a healthy, supported way. The worst is that train scene where Jerry O'Connell is sobbing because Rob Reiner was like screaming at them because they weren't moving fast enough and they weren't looking scared enough and they weren't. And he finally just like lost his temper and was screaming at them. And that's an 11-year-old kid. And the tears he's sobbing are real because this person that he's trusting to take care of him and direct him in this movie has just screamed at him. So that's the worst in direct. I mean, I work with kids. I've directed kids for 20 years. Like, never once would it cross my mind to like really scream at a kid like that to get the reaction I want. And that just feel, that's what's holding me back from saying it's capital G great. Maybe it's just the mom and me.
Well, no, I didn't know that. Again, I'd done alarmingly small amount of research deliberately. So I didn't know that. So you're referring obviously to the scene, because there's a couple of train scenes.
There's a couple
of scenes where they're running across the bridge.
When Jerry and Gordy, when Gordy and Vern are running away from the train that's coming. And I mean, you know, the scenes when they were running, they were not in danger because they shot an enforced perspective. The train was all the way on the other side of the bridge.
Long lens,
Yeah, long lens. Like the kids were never in any real danger. But I guess that was like the issue. Like they weren't running like they were scared. And he was getting tired of them. He was telling them like the crew is tired of pushing the camera on the tracks and this and that. And like, this is all your fault. And you need to, you know, blah, and just lost his temper with them, which I understand. Mm. It's hard. Making a movie is hard.
It's hard, stressful, and you're yelling at kids. What are you doing?
It's hard and stressful. Yeah. But now you're going to yell at these kids. And yeah, we've mentioned it a couple of times. Jerry O'Connell was 11 years old. He was a baby.
Mm.
So
he might have been spaced out at the time. Who knows?
Poor thing. So, you know, finding that story made me kind of, you know,
I get it.
Sure.
I get it. I mean, hey, there's somewhat impacts. I mean, for me, it was mostly the fat phobia, homophobia, that sort of stuff. Like, it just really holds me back. Like there's things that like I can sit there and say, yeah, do boys act like this? They certainly did in the past. Yeah. I could believe it. I get it. But it's also just like, it's like a barrage, you know, like so I struggle with that. Ian, capital G great.
You know, I think I'm in a similar boat as Violet. I really admire so much about this movie. Like I get like, if someone did tell me, even if we don't think it might happen a lot, if somebody did, if I ran into Rebecca Romijn and she told me that this was her favorite movie, like I would get it. Like I certainly wouldn't be like, oh, that's a Batman Begins, really? I wouldn't like. But I,
you calm down, New World.
That still hurts so much. That's why I have to say that. But I think that
just lashing out.
It is still hurts so badly. Listen to the draft episode. There is a quality to it that it is, you know, it is at once a movie about which one can feel very nostalgic and a movie about nostalgia, or at least that evokes nostalgia in its telling. You know, I think for me, you know, hearing the Richard Dreyfuss narration and the, you know, the note that the movie ends on in particular, like I had forgotten like the exact emotional beat that it hits at the very, very end. And I was really struck by it this time, as I probably was the first time, because I have said hello and goodbye to enough, you know, wonderful friends at this point in my life that I'm very tapped into that feeling of time has passed and I have all these memories and the people attached to them are still alive. They're out there somewhere living their lives, and I'm sure I I occupy a similar space in their minds, but we aren't in each other's lives anymore, like at all, and haven't been for many years at this point. And that is, it's a strange but powerful feeling. And I do think the movie is successful in evoking that for me. And so I have a lot of respect for it, but I probably wouldn't put it in the all-time great category personally.
Mm. Me too. Andy, do you make the, what's the word I'm looking for? The four of us, all of us. Is it a full house?
No.
So it is capital G great.
I would put it as a capital G great for three reasons.
Fair enough.
Mm.
It never wants to be some sort of manifesto or stylistic landmark or myth of American, small town Americana.
Mm-hmm.
It hits for an emotional truth without its spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that precision, I think that's a mark of greatness. Number two, I think that the way that it marks exactly how important small things can be. One walk, one weekend, one conversation, that one person that believes in you.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
That can shape and reframe an entire life. And that's an emotional truth and emotional insight. And then in its ending, it doesn't pull its punch. It actively wounds you. It tells you the cost of the characters. It tells you about Chris's fate. That's a level of understanding that you wouldn't normally expect from a film that is often cited as being about nostalgia. It's in no way radical. It's in no way visually iconic. It's in no way shouting its greatness from the rooftops, but that's, I think, its greatness. I think that its truthfulness makes it capital G great.
Good points, well made. I would say, so that's three lower G greats and one capital G great. Is that fair? That sounds fair.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a strong recommendation either way from all of us. Yeah. What's for left sure. Now is the MVP.
I mean, it has to be River Phoenix for me. He is just the beating heart of this movie. Every second he's on screen, he's dynamic. And it is just so heartbreaking to see him and know the career he could have had ahead of him if he hadn't died so tragically. And I mean, it's not even just like all, we've hit on a lot of his like emotional, very dramatic beats, but he has some of the most laugh out loud moments in this movie. When he hands Gordy the gun and then the gun goes off, their faces, it's like watching the Three Stooges. Their faces are so, like, I laughed out loud. It's hysterical. Like, he has every single thing he does in this movie is just pitch perfect, from his comedic beats to his dramatic beats, and how he really ties those four boys together as a team with him just like firmly as the leader. It's a masterclass. As far as a child's performance, it's unbelievable.
It's about as good as I've seen from a kid. And I'll also say, yes, River Phoenix for me as well. And I don't know how much of that is that nostalgia, like, you know, like hearing about him dying and that storyline and all that. I mentioned this in the intro, but I think it stands on its own. I do. I think it's, yeah. And I love that you point out, Vi, that it's not just the emotional authenticity that's so believable about him. It's also like what draws other people to him. It's his charisma. He is funny. Mm. And he does nail those comedic moments too. Like, he's believable entirely. So no, that's an easy one for me, I think. Andy, what do you think?
I think my MVP would be Rob Reiner because of the restraint that I mentioned about it being capital G great. I think that he balances scenes like the leech scene. It's gross. Mm. The train dodging is thrilling. The gun confrontation is tense. It's about existential dread and grief and fear and humor and parents. And I think that to manage all of those tones together alongside gaining four great child performances. Yes, River Phoenix is the engine of the entire film, but to coax four brilliant performances out of these young boys, Rob Reiner, yes, okay, overstepped the mark in the example cited by Violet, but very often we've said that when you have a great performance from a child actor, it very often you have to point to the director for making the environment right for them to give that performance. And I think that he also manages to protect the performances of the lead characters and the lead actors. He doesn't sort of have reaction shots. He doesn't overly cut certain moments. And I think that when you've got Rob Reiner's ability to sort of step out the way, you look at that great run of films. What is Rob Reiner's style? He gets out the way. Mm. He lets greatness happen.
Frank Capra.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why I'd put him as my MVP.
Yeah, good choice. At least that will make the social media interesting. We have more than one option. Ian, what do you think for MVP?
I too struggled between the two of those options. I think I was going to say Rob Reiner for sure until I heard about the fact that Jerry O'Connell's tears were because he had screamed at him. But I also think that I'd be lying if I picked someone else. I think that River Phoenix's performance is astonishing and is absolutely who I would give it to from a performance perspective. Performance MVP, unquestionably. But also the anecdote that Violet shared about Rob Reiner directing him when he was having trouble, like that, that moment is really impactful. That is one of the moments that we all come away from this movie remembering, and probably everybody who watches this movie remembers. And that is a movie, that is a moment that exists in this movie because Rob Reiner directed this young man successfully, did something that many, many great directors cannot rise to the occasion of directing one good child performance. And this movie contains many. And that is a challenge that I think we just have to, on some level, like just tip our caps to Rob Reiner and say, like, you know, this is why you deserve to be remembered as well as you know, unfortunately now posthumously are.
Yeah. And I want to be like super, super clear. Like, again, like I do. I love Rob Reiner. Like, I don't want that moment to like hold me back. And I
know you hate him.
Like, and I and I can't like imagine the amount of stress he was under because this movie was only being made pretty early.
He wasn't
in his
being
because,
his best self that day.
Of course, because Norman Lear put up the budget for the movie because he believed in Rob Reiner so much. Like, he was a relatively untested director being given this movie. Norman Lear was paying for it. He had an unbelievable amount of stress on his brain, a lot of pressure on his shoulders. He had a bad moment. Like, I don't want to, you know, I don't really want to like hold that against him. It's just in my head. It's just in, you know, it's just in there. Yeah. But like, believe me, guys. Don't get me started on When Harry Met Sally. We'll be here all night.
So basically, it's either you like people yelling at children if you vote for Rob Reiner, or you fucking hate Rob Reiner if you voted for River Phoenix. It's one of the two. Like you desecrate his name.
We've learned anything about the times in which we live. It's that.
Yes. Oh, it's
No nuance. Like, let's
zero.
Just, you know, yeah. You want to know a funny fact, guys?
Sure.
I very much intended on this episode being an hour. It's just very funny to me that's so unrealistic for us. Okay. So
is it because we're approaching the actual length of Stand By Me?
Correct. Yeah,
well, we are. And when you add in my 4-minute intro, it will have cleared it. So let's wrap it up. Team, thank you very much for joining me for a brand new season of Movieversaries. It's a pleasure, as I mentioned at the end of last season, to to share this space with you guys and to do our little pod, and we're all very proud of it. So thank you very much for joining me again in the biggest sense of this year, but also for this episode today. I will quickly shout out that Violet, if you want to hear more of Vi's stuff, she does Three Circles, a Disney podcast for film stories. The link is in the show notes in her link tree. So please go check that out. Ian, he does three other shows for film stories, which is The Collector's Commentary, Elimination Above All, and We Are Starfleet. All those links are in the show notes as well. And We Are Starfleet starting back up, actually. There's been a couple of episodes very recently.
Yes.
Today.
Starting back up with Starfleet Academy coverage as of today.
We're going back to school, y'all.
And Andy's other show is Frame to Frame, also on the Film Stories Podcast Network. So check that out as well. And my other show is Academy Watch. All those links are in the show notes. Please go and check those out. Thank you so much for being here with us today. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Movieversaries. Give us a rating of 5 stars, a review if you're able to on your app. And most importantly, if you have a friend that loves film history, do give them our information. And also, while you're in the show notes checking out the other shows that me and my co-hosts do, there's also a link to the Discord. Come on in, have a chat. We'll chat about film history and other things like music or just general stuff. We do that. I don't know. It's fun. But until then, Violet, Ian, Andy, thank you all very much as they all wave and smile to me. And thank you to the listeners. We'll see you for the next installment of Movieversaries.